Good afternoon. Good afternoon. President Staver will not be present today, so I'm going to just pro temp go ahead and get the meeting going. This is the October 23rd Committee of the Whole meeting, and a couple things I just want to throw out for clarity today. This Committee of the Whole, as usual, is a discussion for the get together for the City Council and the staff, so there will not be public testimony today. We will have that opportunity down the road when we get into any public hearings, and you'll be notified of that. So I want to make sure that's clear. We've got three items today, and I'm going to try to keep us right on that timeline. So the first one would be the county HRA presentation by Dave Dunn. Hi, Dave.
Can we do it here, or should I just
come on?
Okay.
Okay.
We're working on the logistics here, so there might be a lot of head nodding, so I want to apologize. Good afternoon, council members. I'm Dave Dunn. I'm the executive director of the HRA. The Olmsted County HRA. I've got some of our board members here in the front row. I want to thank them for coming today. Just wanted to start with what our mission is. It's to provide Olmsted County residents opportunities to obtain quality, affordable housing. So that's kind of who we are and what we do. How do we do that and who do we serve? Well, we provide housing assistance for 2,756 people in Olmsted County. Of those, the average household size is a little bit over four. The average income is about $22,000 a household, and that includes any kind of SNAP or SSI assistance. Our age breakdown on there shows that we serve a high number of children under the age of 18. 80% of our clients are non-white, and 98% of them reside in Rochester. This is a picture of the housing continuum, and if you can all read that, you have much better eyesight than I do. What you need to know is on the left side really starts at your near homelessness, and your right side goes all the way to kind of market rate housing. If you go to the next slide, you'll kind of see where the different entities interact. And for the most part, the county has programs that deal with people who are in transitional near homelessness. We really work with kind of that next tier from there, really that 20 to 50% AMI level. And then beyond that, you see the city with a lot of the TIF assistance in the Rochester Area Foundation has some assistance programs as well. But I think it's good to understand kind of where we fit within the framework of housing in the community for the most part. Now, we do have other programs and they touch more, but this is the nuts and bolts of what we do. So what assistance programs do we provide? The first one is the Housing Choice Voucher Program, commonly referred to as Section 8. The way the program works, participants pay 30% of their income in rent. The voucher pays for the rest. Basically, the way that it works, so if you have $1,000 of income a month, you pay $300 a month in rent. The difference between $300 and whatever that market rate rent is made up by us. It's called the housing assistance payment. So you can see there a little bit more about it. The eligibility requirements, the maximum income is 50% of the area median income. And I apologize already for throwing all of these numbers. You can't talk about housing without way too many numbers, but we're going to try to simplify that a little bit. But if you see there, for a family of four, the maximum income is $44,000. 75%, however, of our participants have to be below that 30% number. Our program itself, we have 537 vouchers allocated to us by HUD. Unfortunately, we don't have the funding for 537. The way funding has been recently, we're looking at more about 500 is the number that we're able to provide those services for. That number is probably going to continue to decrease depending upon federal funding levels. Along with that, one of the other struggles in the program that we have is that tenants struggle to find housing. And that's not just here locally, that's nationwide, that people think once they receive a voucher, their ability to find housing is going to be a lot easier. In fact, at times it can be a lot harder. So that's a struggle we have. And in 2016, you see there that 235 landlords locally received about $3.2 million in rental assistance. Another thing we do is property ownership. We have 261 housing units in Olmsted County, the vast majority of which are located in the city of Rochester, and you can kind of see the breakdown there. The largest program we serve in that area is the public housing program. The program started in the early 1980s. One of the things I know that Gary Newman mentioned this a couple of weeks ago as far as the development of affordable housing. At one time, way back in the 60s and 70s, when a lot of the high-rises were being built, they bypassed Rochester. Largely, the population wasn't what it was. we weren't as interested locally in the program either. So our program in public housing began much later. In some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad, because we don't have as many units. We only have 110, and we have the three 30-unit townhome complexes. Again, these are all in Rochester, and these are in public housing. Again, these are owned and operated units by the HRA, in which the tenant pays 30% of their income in rent. Oh, we got these. Sorry about that. Tried to get fancy on my slides, and it didn't work. We serve 415 people in that program, and you can see there the average income is $18,000 a year. These are very low-income individuals. We actually, that wait list number is 400. It's actually 500. I apologize for that, but you can see that just like with the voucher program, there's a significant wait for that as well. We also have several housing projects for specific populations. You can kind of read through all these here. I'm not going to go through them. The one thing I will highlight on there is the Gage East project. That's one that we've partnered successfully with Center City on and several other agencies, both in the county and otherwise, and we've created 20 voucher spots there. So 20 of the families that live at Gage East have a permanent housing choice voucher attached to the unit. We also have a couple of properties that are what I would consider below market rate. We have these listed right here. The one I'll notice is the flood homes that are donated from the city back during the flood control project days. That was extremely successful for us. It's been a wonderful opportunity for us, and we anticipate more of those partnerships in the future. So if you have any other homes that you have, we'd love to have them. But no, we appreciate those partnerships, and you see that we have other things that are more near market rate in the community as well. One program I'll point out in just a little bit more detail is our HRA Housing Rehab Program. So this is a program that we recently started. We launched the program back in April of 2017. We've gotten 14 loans now in progress through this. It's really based on the city's CDBG Housing Rehab Program. We knew that was a very successful program, but at the time the wait list was 1 to 2 years, so we knew substantially that the need outweighed the supply that we had for funds, and so what we did... It's a lot of feedback.
Is that
under my combination? Is that better? All right. Well, maybe not. Maybe if I step back. Probably could just shout. I think you could all hear me just fine. The rehab program we've created is based largely in part on the city's CDBG program. The CDBG program here has been extraordinarily successful. We've done about 400 loans in the last 25 years. When we looked at doing this as the HRA, we didn't want to recreate the wheel. You've got a program that worked, and so what we've done is we've added to it. We've added two loan products. The rehabilitation loan is essentially the same loan product and program that you have with the CDBG program. And then we've added an accessibility loan, which is really for disabled residents or seniors to help them stay in their home. That loan's forgiven. The rehab loan has a 2% interest rate, which for all of you up here should sound very familiar because it's the same interest rate that we have with the CDBG program. The nice thing about this, it does hit locations outside of the city of Rochester, but you can see in here the vast majority of the work that we have done has been inside the community as well. A component we've added into the HRA and recently has been the merger with the Community Housing Partnership, and with that we've added homebuyer education classes. So we are now doing homebuyer education, homebuyer counseling, and foreclosure counseling. So these are new services to us as a community. They're new services that we can provide that CHP was providing. Along another one of those types of programs is the Minnesota Housing City Participation Program, and that's an easy one to say without a glass of water. Essentially what it does, it allows residents of Olmsted County, including Rochester, access to down payment funding from Minnesota Housing, and that's another program that we started back in 2017. So we do a lot of different things, but we face a lot of obstacles. The first one is that we have more demand for assistance than we have supply. We get phone calls every day. I sit right outside of the main line number. And my poor support person, Katie, does a wonderful job answering the phone. She gets person after person who calls that are in stress, that are in severe stressful situations where housing is an emergency situation, and unfortunately we don't have great resources to help them. Our programs right now that we run all have wait lists. You can see there the Housing Choice Voucher Program, so for Section 8, the last time that wait list was opened was in 2012. We still have approximately 700 families on that wait list. So we have, we've made it about halfway through our original 1,400 in that time. The public housing waitlist was last opened in early 2016, and that has about 500 families on it today. So the demand for the assistance is far exceeds the supply that we have. We have our own financial constraints. So we are a financially independent entity from Olmsted County. So as much as I like to give the folks at the county a hard time, we have to make kind of our financial ends meet on our own, which is good, bad, ugly, and different. It just is. But when we have issues like this house here, we have to fix them, and they cost a lot of money. This is actually a house that's right down from where I live. It's 903 29th Street, and this was a house that had a bowing foundation wall. Unfortunately, the only way to fix it was to jack up the whole half of the house and redo the wall underneath it. Before the levy was approved, we had very limited financial resources to do it, and frankly, we've had significant deferred maintenance because we haven't had the financial resources over time to keep up all the things that we've needed. I think we're improving on that, but there's still work to be done. Other financial constraints, our local match for our HUDs programs is increasing. Our Housing Choice Voucher Program runs at about a $300,000 deficit. That's made up with levy funds. It's anticipated that to grow to about $450,000 next year due to a decrease in funding and an increase of costs. It's much the same thing that we're seeing in other government areas. And then the uncertainty, the acknowledgement of the uncertainty of the funding sources in which we utilize. We receive about $4 million every year from HUD. The president's proposed budget would cut that by about $627,000. Now, we aren't sure where that's going to go or if it's going anywhere. I know that some appropriations bills are working through Congress, but we don't know. And we don't know what's going to happen with our programs. Our voucher program was in shortfall for a lot of 2017, which means that it ran a deficit. And quite frankly, we had to ensure that we wouldn't have to remove anyone from the program. And so we were doing that, and that was one of the things that we've had to face. So one of the questions I get all the time is, where does the levy money go? And so I thought the easiest way to do it would just be put it right on the screen for y'all to see. The levy is $1.35 million. So you see right there the HUD program match is about $300,000. Our HRA administrative costs are about $190,000. Our HRA homeowner rehab program is $400,000. Our homeless prevention funds are $100,000. And those funds have actually been allocated to prevent having to remove people from the voucher program in 2017. So that essentially that was our insurance policy in case we ran a program deficit. And then the last line on there is affordable housing development of $500,000. And those funds haven't been allocated, and I'll touch on that in a slide in a bit. So moving forward, where do we go from here? Well, for us, the first thing is to create a financially sustainable organization. If we don't have the resources that we need to be a sustainable organization, we can't help people in the community. Now, the flip side is if we don't help people in the community, there's no reason to invest in our organization. And it is a catch-22, but we have to do what we need to become sustainable. So we've been working on a financial management plan, implementing that. We're looking at a modernization plan for all 261 units of housing that we own. We're looking at diversifying our funding sources. And then we're looking at some of the new programs that we've talked about. The levy development funds, so one of the other things that's next for us, what's the best way to invest those funds in the community? It's $500,000 a year, and in some ways that's a lot of money, but in other ways, as you know, when you look at the funds available and the needs for development, it's not a lot of money. And so what we have to do is look at really two options. And the first one is, do we look at investing in HRA-owned and operated property and developing ourselves, or do we look at providing gap financing for developers, which is the second option? And right now, our board's working on that and chewing on that decision. I think they're working toward a decision on that relatively in the near future, and I hope to be able to kind of get back to you what that looks like here as we move forward. And then framing the conversation around housing in the community. One of the things I think we need to think of is we need to start thinking of housing as infrastructure, just like we do sewers and streets and water and all the other things. We need to address the market failure of affordable housing. You know, I go to a lot of meetings like all of you do, and a lot of housing always comes up, and it's a lot of the same conversations. But frankly, the issue with affordable housing is it costs more to build it than the revenue you can get from it. It's a market failure. we have to address that if we want to grow as a community, if we want to invite the workforce in. And I really think we need to look at that as infrastructure, just like we would anything else. The next thing we need to do is kind of frame the conversation as a community. Right now, we're all over the map when it comes to what does housing mean, what should we do, what are the issues. You might go to a meeting and you might have people who are talking about market rate housing and homelessness, and it's just all kind of a jumbled mess. And I really think we need to take just a little bit of time to frame the conversation in those different pieces of the continuum, to try to help frame what that conversation is. And the last thing I just want to point out there to help with that as well is we're creating a new website, olmstedcountyhousing.com. It's our new HRA website. It's also a county website, so it's just an easier way to get to the information that we have. And finally, what we need to do is to continue to enhance partnerships. We can't do this alone. The city can't do it alone. The county can't do it alone. The private sector can't do this alone. But we can make impacts when we work together. And we've worked together on a lot of successful partnerships on our River's Edge building that we own. The city donated the land to the HRA, which made that project possible. The Gage East project, we've got organizational partnerships. So when we look at Pathways to Prosperity, one of the things about being located now in Olmsted County Community Services is that we're looking at how do we enhance the lives of our clients and tenants. It's more than just a place to live, but once we provide that stable housing for people, we can work on the other issues that they have in their lives, and we can actually build that pathway to prosperity, and it's a pretty exciting thing. We talked a little bit about the HRA-CHP merger. We're working on trying to absorb their programs and their properties, and we're always working with the planning department. They've got great people and great staff that really take the leadership role on policy issues and working with them to make sure that our rehab programs work together in a lot of different ways. And then, as you see, some of these other partnerships, one I'll point out is our tax forfeiture property program. So one of the other new things that we're doing is as properties come through the tax sale process, instead of just automatically sending them out to auction, what we've done is we're pulling them back, and we've asked nonprofits if they're interested in developing those as affordable housing opportunities. We've got, I think, two or three that are in the pipeline right now. Again, this isn't a silver bullet, but it's an easy thing for us to do, and as the HRA, we can kind of facilitate that process. The city could, too, if they would choose. I think we're just taking that on as something that we can look at in our areas that we serve. But how do we continue to serve the needs? You're the city council for the city of Rochester. We're your HRA. We need to know how do we continue to serve the needs of the community, because that's what we're here to do, is to serve the needs of the community. So in closing, I want to thank you for your time. I want to thank everyone here for listening, and want to ask you for continued partnership and continued working together to address this issue.
Okay. Dave, very good. Very good presentation. Very thorough.
Did I hit my time?
You're right on.
I had 28 slides in 25 minutes.
Yeah,
there'll be a lot of information that you can pull up later. I apologize.
Yeah, and will that staff, will that be sent out? Is that available to the council? I think you're just very, very good. Okay, questions, council? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a few questions as we worked through it. So I didn't see the number for the demand of the housing choice vouchers. What was that number? I know there's a backlog. I'm just trying to get an idea how big it is.
Our wait list is right now about 700.
And the other aspect I was looking for those programs is it seems like there has to be a housing price maximum, because you're doing kind of like a gap payment between what the future tenant can afford and the cost of the housing. What's the maximum range between those two numbers?
I'll just give you one number, because I can give you a whole bunch more offline and say what we have is called a payment standard. And the payment standard is based on HUD sets fair market rent. So they look at rents in Rochester, and they say this is what a two-bedroom should rent for. And then the 40th percentile, so 50% is that median rent, 40% is fair market rent. And then we have a little bit of range in there to make our payment standards. And for a two-bedroom, that's $875.
Okay, so someone affording $300 a month for their payment would get $575 to make the gap. Is that
correct? Okay. And so then there's a range of apartments in which they could rent. And I had a slide that got into it, but it got really confusing really quick. And with all of the information we were hitting, I thought I'd just leave it out. But yes.
Sorry, it's a battery. So I apologize to my fellow council members. The follow-on I'd like to see for a number is like our vacancy inside of that that particular kind of market. So we call them fair market, but if it's the 40th, the lower 40%, like what's our actual tenancy vacancy available in that range? Because I'm guessing it's near zero.
I would guess so too. We don't have any updated info. I wish I had a number I could say, oh, it's 2.3%, but we don't have anything to guess.
Could you just give me a narrative around that? If you're able to find something, I'd prefer to have a solid number, but if there's some way that we're calculating that on a regular basis, because I think that again goes to one of these unaddressable aspects of these programs. The rehab program, I know there's a great demand for that. I think we said, is there 100 names on our list, or is it, you guys have a couple hundred? Well, let's see what we're planning here. I think between the HRA and the city, I'd really like to see us push that list to zero. That seems like a, you know, it's an investment in the community. So, you know, I'd like to see what it would take, you know, over 5 years or a decade to bring that number to zero, to say, we don't have as many people waiting. I understand more people will come, but certainly that's an investment. It's a rotating fund, so that money stays there. And I don't know, that'll be a question I'll follow up with later to our staff about the eligibility of some of the dollars we would potentially get off of this TIF fund and whether or not we could use that to finance some of those affordable changes. I think we have to find a way to drive that to zero. The most affordable housing stock we have is housing that's already built. So any way we can keep that up is positive. And then the only other thing, and my closing comment was, I really appreciated your comment regarding the difficulty in addressing kind of what is a market failure for the affordable housing. It really is, and we really need to take stock of that as we kind of evaluate options. But thank you for being here and doing the presentation. And I pledge I will continue to work with you and your group to move this forward. Tell us about Build Back.
Thank you, Mr. Ruska. Dave, we looked at foreclosed housing. We still have some here in town. Is that an option to try to get a hold of that, to rehab that into housing?
It can be. I haven't looked at it very much here, to be very honest with you. I worked on foreclosures for about 5 years of my life, so I know a little bit about this. If we know there's a property that's foreclosed on and we can help facilitate a transfer, we can, but what's there... there's not a ton of stuff there. There are a few, but if we had one that, you know, or two, you know, what I've talked about when somebody's mentioned this to me before, it's easier if we know the property to say, hey, what can we do the backstory on this property on? And if we can try to find something, as we do a foreclosure, certainly that's something that we can look at, to say, as an organization, do we want to do more with single family homes? It's all a trade-off, but it's certainly something we can evaluate.
And I do appreciate your time and your explanations. I know there's a lot of numbers. Can you kind of give play with your numbers of 40% to 60%, the difference in what kind of subsidy there is in that kind of those two places from a 40 to 60?
I'm going to actually defer that to Terry because I think you have that number.
Well, just off the top of my head, a while back, I think I prepared a memo that provided the council some information related to that. My recollection, and again, this is off the top of my head, but the difference that we found in a common market rate rent versus a rent that's affordable at that 60% median income level was about $200 per month difference in rent. And then to get down to the 50% AMI level, from a market rate rent, that was about $360 per month difference in rent. So pretty substantial.
One way we've looked at this, and now I'm going to throw out a number, and the minute I do, I'm going to come back and say it's not right. But we did look at this on 60 to 40, and we looked using some of Terry's numbers over the course of 20 years, and I think it was about $70,000 per unit for 20 years to get from 60 to 40. It's a substantial amount of money. Especially when you talk about that's just one housing unit over the course of a lifespan of what you'd think of as an affordability period.
Thank you.
Dave, I had one question about the serve on the HRA board years ago, and this homebuyer education class is kind of interesting. I don't recall hearing about that before. How do you get it out there? How do you let people know about it? Who teaches it, and how well received has it been so far?
So we just took this on. It was part of our merger with the Community Housing Partnership. So Judy Plank's group did this for years and years and did a very nice job with it. As that group has merged into the HRA, we've taken on, starting really officially in October, is our first month that we've had it, although our staff has been facilitating the classes now for the last 3 months. So what we've been doing is working with our local realtors and then lenders to really try to target that outreach. Now, honestly, we need to do more of it. We need to let the community know that it's a resource available, because it's a great way to learn about buying a home, what it means. I mean, it's an 8-hour class, so it's very detailed, and it gets into a lot of budgeting, it gets into maintenance needs, it gets into talking about realtors and loan products and a lot of great things. And so it's on our website now, and if you call the HRA at 328-7150, we can sign anyone up.
Okay, and you guys actually do that?
Yes.
So no one has done it yet? It's just
We have been doing it for the last 3 months.
Okay.
So it's a new program, but we've done it a few times, and we've had about 5 people per class or 5 couples per class.
Very good. All right. Well, I appreciate your time, and thank you. Anything else staff wants to add?
Right on time.
Good.
All right.
Thank you, Dave.
Other than we appreciate working with Dave and the county HRA, and we look forward to continuing that.
Next, we have the affordable housing recommendation impacts, which are attached here by administration.
So if the council remembers back on September 18th, our office presented the city's past affordable housing efforts in the past. And as part of that PowerPoint presentation that we gave, we also listed some potential recommendations that we would suggest moving forward that could potentially increase the number of affordable housing units in the community. As far as our recommendation, we had 6 recommendations that day. The first recommendation talked about the statutory housing TIF districts. A second recommendation was redevelopment TIF of small projects. The third was the redevelopment TIF housing lane projects. The fourth is the redevelopment TIF projects. The fifth was the single family home development. And also then the last recommendation was a recommendation in regards to the incentive and restricted development processes in the LDM manual. So the first recommendation is the statutory housing TIF districts. According to Minnesota statutes, a housing TIF district has to have at least 40% of the units be reserved for those incomes at 60% of the AMI or lower. The city has historically required through the development assistance agreement that 100% of the units be reserved for those individuals at 60% of the AMI or lower. So, Terry, if you want to go to the next slide. You will see it since 2015, the city has created 713 affordable housing units at that 60% of AMI. The total amount of assistance that the city has given out is about $5.1 million in assistance. That equals about $7,229 per unit for affordable units. Next slide, Terry. The second recommendation was in the redevelopment small TIF projects without federal fundings. I guess I consider those projects would be below $50 million in construction cost. You can see in the last couple of years, we've done the 501 First project, which has 84 units. Our recommendation would be that if we would require 20% of the units at 60 AMI, that development would require 17 units. If the council adopted some policy at 10% at 50 AMI, that development would require 8 units. Which should point out, on the Miracle Mile project, according to the development assistance agreement, they are required to have 20% of the units at 60 AMI, so they are required to have 22 units made affordable. And then on the residents at the Discovery Square project, that project also requires, as part of the development assistance agreement, to have 20% of the units at 60 AMI, so they are creating 29 units of affordable. And then on the Buckeye, which is known as the Flats on 4th project, that development assistance agreement requires that 20% of the units be available for 10% at 50% of the AMI, so they're required to have 19 units. So based on these recommendations of the last couple of projects, if we had some that requirement in policy at 20% at 60 AMI, we'd have about 117 units, or we would have about 58 units at 10% of 50 AMI. But I should point out, based on the three projects that have development assistance agreements, we have 51 units at 20% AMI and 19 units at 10% of 50% AMI based on the existing development agreements on those three projects.
If I could just comment, the policy question for you on this is basically what we suggested. Instead of, we've done it out of, for three of the projects out of the five, that basically it would become a mandatory requirement rather than optional. So you would be doing it for all the similar type projects going forward, where we didn't do it on two of these, but we did do it on three of them.
Thank you, Tim. The third recommendation was on the redevelopment only housing TIF projects. And these are different from the statutory housing projects. These are redevelopment TIF projects where, and these have to meet the but-for test. So they're basically removal of blighted properties. We've had two recent projects that have been redevelopment that had only housing as part of their project. The first one being the Lofts at Mill Park that has a total of 29 units. So 20% of the units at 60 AMI would equal 6 units, and then 10 units at 50 AMI would equal 3 units. The Riverwalk Apartments, which was recently approved by the council earlier this year, that has a total of 152 units. So at 20% of 60% AMI, that would be 30 units. Then it would be 15 units at 10% at 50 AMI. I should point out that on the Riverwalk Apartments project, the city is capturing 20% of the available TIF for affordable housing. So it is estimated that if the district ran for 25 years, the city could collect approximately $1.8 million to be used for affordable housing. That's only if the TIF district would run for 25 years. It's likely in this case that once the city's obligations are met for the developer, that TIF district would be closed and would not run the full 25 years, but it would close once our obligations to the developer are met. So that district may be closed in 15 or 20 years, whenever our obligations are met.
Again, the policy recommendation is that you require these going forward rather than basically making it optional. And I think in these cases, we've either captured the percentage of TIF, and sometimes on these you can capture a greater percentage, or you get units in it. But that basically we're saying going forward, we recommend that you have one, have a requirement for all of these projects.
Excellent. So the fourth requirement or recommendation was the redevelopment projects with no housing or large multi-unit projects that the city would collect 5% of the available increment. I think this has probably the greatest impact for the community. As you can see, some of the past projects, as far as the amount of increment that the project is expected to generate in a duration of 25 years and the 5% of the increments, but we can't really go back on those projects that are even approved by the city. But we did list five future projects based on what we've been working with on developers and what we envision on coming in the future. Potentially there could be about $350,000 collected per year of increment that the city could use for affordable housing. And that's based on just five projects listed, but as time goes on, the project list would continue to grow and grow, so that number could be quite a bit higher than the $355,000 per year estimated in this document.
Brent, if I could ask you to go back to point three. I know Gary mentioned that would require those numbers, but at the end of that you have or secure a percentage of the TIF for affordable housing. So can you just, you did touch on that, can you just kind of update us on what, is that one or the other is what the requirement would be then?
For number three?
Yeah,
it was either one or the other. It was either you have a percentage of units at either 60% or 50% AMI or collect a percentage of that TIF for affordable housing.
I think the reason was because sometimes there's different needs in a project and you'd have some flexibility to negotiate those, as we have negotiated on some of these other projects, but we probably want to take whatever looks to be the best fit.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we weren't just requiring the portion of it, but you know that how that would work. We would have one or the other, and that would be determined by staff?
Through negotiation, but then we'd have to bring it forward to you, and you would make the final decision.
Okay. Thank you.
So that's point to point out on this scenario here, this 5% increment. It's these numbers are based on the TIF district being open for 25 years, but once the city's obligations for the developer are met, that TIF district can't stay open. It has to be closed by the city. So if the project is done within 20 years, we can't keep that district open for 5 additional years once our obligations are met for the developer. So,
Mr. Chair, just a question. Your point is on page 4 of our packet on the asterisk under section 3, correct? Is that you were asking?
My question was on actually the first page.
Okay. I'm trying to follow your point.
On the first page for point 3.
Oh, okay, point 3. Okay. Right. Yeah, because there's also this asterisk underneath section 3 in the body.
Right, I didn't see it there and it wasn't mentioned, but it was on the other part on the first page. So that's where I was just wanting some clarity there.
So then the next slide just kind of shows a graph of the amount of money that could be collected by the city. And this graph is based on those projects listed in the packets, including some of the past projects that have been approved by the city. But starting with the orange line would be the 5 potential projects that we see coming down the pipeline within the next 3 to 4 years. Looking for TIF assistance.
Originally, we did this as you asked for an estimate of what it might do, and you know, sometimes it's easier going back to the past to see what it would have done, so we kind of combine that in here. I would think if this continues, you know, you're likely to do additional TIF projects. I think you could be well over $500,000 a year if this process keeps going forward. When we first recommended this, we didn't know of anybody else in Minnesota or elsewhere that was doing this. I subsequently heard I think Seattle does something similar to this, and somebody was mentioning that maybe St. Paul did some of this, but we hadn't heard of that before that point. So it'd be a new effort for us and one that's not real common at this point.
And I think the fifth recommendation was just continue to do the single family housing assistance. Since 1999, the city has provided TIF assistance on 367 lots. So that's quite a few lots since 1999. The last part of our recommendation was based on the restricted and incentive development provisions of the ordinance. Basically, that was whenever a project has 10 or more units above what is allowed in the either restricted or the underlying zoning district, that we would take 10% of that difference for affordable units. So going back the last 10 years, those projects are listed on the screen before you. You can see that if we had taken the 10% of the number of units above the base number, we'd have about 28 units of affordable housing created through the incentive and restricted development process. And I was just trying to point out what our recommendations from last month's meeting, what it would look like as far as number-wise, as far as various projects passing in the future.
Councilmember Hickey.
I was going to mention one more thing. Relating to this, we kind of were talking recently in our office about one of the same things actually that Michael brought up, is that one thing we were kind of surprised with this one is that there weren't more units, but the reason was we had gone back and in some areas of town had been some fairly significant rezonings to R3 and up classes of property, which then takes away some of the bounce in getting additional units. There would be an option, and it maybe isn't quite as, there's a fairness issue, and then there's a getting affordable housing issue, but the other way of looking at it is you may want to think about, because we haven't made a final decision on what we would recommend on this, but we did want to bring it up, is you maybe don't need to calculate the base. I mean, if they're going through incentive and restricted development, you could say it applies to all the units, and 10% of the number of the units approved would be a much higher number than 10% after you subtract off the base of what they were allowed on the property. Do you follow? Mm-hmm. And so basically, according to my calculations, instead of having 28 units, if you did that, you would have had about 53, and since I'm dropping that on you in a cold, that is something that we considered too, because there was some fairly big rezonings that took place that kind of affect that, and so that's something you might want to give some thought to.
Okay.
Yeah, like second item four, where there's no housing component, we talked about setting up a housing, affordable housing fund that they would contribute to. And some of these other options, such as the one we're looking at with incentive and restricted development, is there, you saw some of the solutions provided by like a consultant that would set up like an in-lieu of fund, that they would have the option to provide the required number of units or contribute to this in-lieu of fund. Would you anticipate something like this, incentive restricted development, that could contribute to an in-lieu of fund, or is this strictly going to be the recommendation that they provide the actual housing units?
That's probably a question for our city attorney, if you can require funds through a zoning matter.
I mean, essentially that's what we're doing on the floor.
Looking at it,
restricted and incentive developments, which are conditional use permits. So as a condition of the issuance of the permit, those could be part of the conditions.
Yeah, I'm just suggesting that if someone, like, for example, not to pick on any one, but the top, you know, the top one, if they didn't want to provide just two units, you know, would they have the option, would you envision they would have the option to contribute to this in-lieu of fund and some of those you know, housing solutions that...
If it's legal, you could do that. I don't think you can do it for rezoning, but, you know, if that's something you want to consider, we can consider that as an option.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I was holding my questions. Are you? Okay. Is this it?
That's it.
I am.
Yeah, but
so for the rest of the council, I think that Councilmember Icky hit on probably what will be one of the more challenging decision points for us, which is allowing these kind of utility funds to bypass actually providing the housing. I have a number of concerns about that. The most principal being that I think my large concern would be a lot of people opting out of it and choosing just to write a check, and then us having to go figure out where to secure the housing. I like the idea, frankly, of more mixed income developments happening. So, you know, to the extent that it's possible, I would like to see us encourage that as a solution here, to encourage it. And to that direction, I agree with the staff. I think that when you said you're surprised by the little number of units that were generated by that incentive zoning policy. So one of the changes I was looking at, just because I like to tweak with the formulas, was can we instead do a percentage that's based on the amount, the ask? So if they're asking for a 100% increase in square footage, then it would be 20%. If they're asking for a 50% increase in square footage, that would be 10%. Make something more a function of what are they asking of the city and how, what should be their kind of obligation to provide more. Because I think on some of these smaller ones, they've actually asked for a very significant change, you know, to get these units to fit. Maybe it's only a 15-unit building, but that actually requires almost 100% increase in the square footage that's allowable in that particular area. So I think there's some different mechanics we could work on there. I think that that's a good way for people to know ahead of the game exactly what our expectation is going to be when they're coming through the process. I have a bunch of other questions, but I'll yield to other council members, because I'm sure I'm not the only one. Else? If I am, I can continue.
Keep it rolling.
All right. I have a few questions, about kind of what was presented today. You kind of said we can't go back and address these districts that already exist.
Unexistent system.
Yep. My recollection is we have amended TIF districts. Is that true or false?
Oh, we've amended. So TIF, yep. We did like the H3 project when that project project changed in scope. They went from like a two-story building to a six-story building. So then that TIF district, or that TIF Development Assistance Agreement was amended at that time based on development costs.
So I guess, I don't know if everyone can see where I'm going. Why wouldn't we go back and readdress some of these to write this back in?
Question of Mr. Svinby, in that amended Development Assistance Agreement, did both parties agree with the amendment?
So if we got agreement from the developer, we had not provided access to their full TIF allocation, for instance, if we had said, no, the number we can agree on is less than what you're capped at,
we could simply get agreement from them to go back, write our 5% in, and start capturing that.
At least from the development assistance agreement standpoint, yes. If both parties agree to amend, you can amend.
I mean, we'd have to see how likely that is. I'm getting grimaces from staff, so I'm guessing it may not be as easy as I like to imagine. But what I was trying to get at is that's not outside of the legal realm. It's probably more outside the realm of...
It's outside the realm in terms of unilateral action.
I'm not looking for unilateral action. Everyone always wants to be a partner until I come to the table looking for a signature. So I'm sure it'll be easier said than done. Second piece.
Counselor? Sure. There's also some bond law regulations related to this. And I guess we'd have to also check on that end because you do a TIF plan and then you do the development agreement. So if it's not in your TIF plan, there are some provisions to amend TIF plans, but I wouldn't just say that... automatic that the answer to that question would be yes.
I figured when you kind of played around not wanting to do it that it might be hard, but I just want to make sure it's not impossible. So it sounds like if we had, if one of these $100 million projects shows up and wants to do it, we would be able to do it.
One that we already have completed, yes.
Perfect.
We could ask both of those questions, but I wanted to point out it's kind of a several-part question.
I understand the you properly narrowed my optimism on that one, but that's my job is to be optimistic and yours is to be realistic sometimes. Why would we need to close the district?
Once the city's obligations are met, then we can't keep the district open because the TIF plan spells out where the monies are going. So once the developer's obligations are met, or once we meet the developer's obligations, we can't keep the district open. Terry can explain it better than I can.
Well, I would like to just clarify that just a little bit. It's not necessarily just the obligation to the developer. The statutes basically indicate, this is for redevelopment type projects. It basically states that 90% of the increments from the project basically have to go to correct the problem that essentially causes the need for the redevelopment district to be established in the first place. So there may be some costs above and beyond what the developer is getting reimbursed for. There may be some street and sewer, other public infrastructure costs that we're using the increment for. But once you get to that 90% threshold, then we're obligated to close the district under the statute.
All right.
So we try to, I mean, it'd be nice to be able to run it out in some instances, maybe as long as we can for the purpose of trying to capture some increment for housing, but we do have that requirement we have to meet there.
Sounds like something we could structure an obligation to take us to 25 years.
Possibly.
We have great staff, and I bet you can find a way to. But it seemed fascinating to me, like we would want to set up, it's like bonding certain things, like sometimes you want to bond them over time so that you have the obligation, correct?
Yeah, the other issue, you know, that we do run across with tax increment financing districts is obviously over a period of time, you know, that's essentially tax capacity that doesn't get to be captured by the county and the school district, so we try to... you'd be reasonable with the duration to the extent that we can. It's kind of a balancing act.
I appreciate that. The only other thing that had crossed my mind was I have actually heard anecdotally of 60% AMI units remaining vacant because the qualifications are kind of hard and people that do qualify still not being able to afford the unit. I wonder if there's a way to structure the obligation to allow flexibility so that if a unit, if two 60% units have sat vacant for 6 months, they can condense them to one 50% unit and one market rate unit to allow some shifting to meet the actual demand. I'm just concerned if we build a lot of 60% AMI units and we don't find a way for people to kind of come back and address where the market, where our population actually needs the support.
I think it's something conceivably that could be done. I think we just have to figure out a way to make sure we get it built into the the TIF plan document and more so probably in that development agreement. You may recall we actually did an amendment a while back on a project with Kutsky Park, Place Apartments, something similar to that, where there were a couple of units that weren't rented, so we changed the mix a little bit. So we had to go back and amend the agreement to do that. But if we can somehow figure out a way to build it in on the front end, it may be a possibility. We certainly can look at that.
Okay, and it may be something we could build a system around to allow potentially a staff review of what is being proposed. Because that would be the other thing, is to separate it from the development agreement, to total up the support cost, put that in the development agreement, but allow and defer that allocation component until we get more information about what's renting and what's not renting. Because it seems really frivolous and wasteful for us to have a 60% AMI unit sitting unused. That would be, that's a loss to us.
So, agreed.
Okay. That's my question.
Okay. Anything else? All right, Brett, thank you, and appreciate it. What's the next step of action on that?
We've probably put this in the document to see if we can bring it forward to the council to approve.
Okay. I'd like to come. I think we talked about coming back for a public hearing. Do you guys want direction for public hearing?
We'd need one.
Okay, because I would. I would direct staff to start it as a public hearing. Okay. Everybody, consensus okay with that? Okay.
Yeah, that would
schedule that then.
These are in the TIF policies, so they'd have to be.
Right, which segues us right into the item 3, which is the city tax increment financing policies. Jerry?
Well, excuse me, my name is Terry Spaeth with City Administration. I do a lot of the work with tax increment financing on behalf of the city as a staff person, along with Gary and Brent and now Steve. I'm bringing this back today just to basically deal with the issue that was discussed a month ago, and basically what Brent and Gary were just kind of going over, to put those recommendations related to the percentages and whatnot into the TIF policy document that the council approved back in February of this year. So I don't know that we need to have a whole lot of discussion about that, because you've been discussing that up until now. So what I'd like to focus the rest of the discussion on is another aspect of the TIF policies, and that relates to the relocation of displaced tenants. This issue came about to the forefront here a while back with a recent tax increment financing project, and so based on that, we felt it would be appropriate to look into it and hopefully maybe at least make some recommendations or suggestions or get the council thinking about it and bring it up as a topic of discussion so that we can hopefully come up with something to put into our document if we so desire, so that we don't have to deal with a situation like we had here a month ago where we found out that there happened to be a displaced tenant sort of at the back end of a project and then kind of had to deal with it. So the first alternative, Brent, if you'll flick the slide, and what I had kind of put into the actual policy document related to actually putting a maximum amount to require a developer to set aside or provide for a displaced tenant. The dollar figure that I put into the policies here, which is attached as part of your packet, equated to $5,250. And where that came from is that particular dollar figure came from a East Coast city of about the same size. And as I was doing research on this, I found that they're kind of all over the board in terms of what's required by different cities. But that was pretty consistent with what we had found and in discussing with the developer that we were working with on the TIF project recently. And so we put into that particular development agreement, you might remember, we actually put in a $5,000 cap. At that time, the council didn't specify anything, but in talking with our TIF bond attorney and the developer, it was like, well, you got to have something here. We can't just leave it open-ended.
So we did put that in. But this 5250 basically boils down to, it provides for 42 months worth of the difference in rent between where that person was at and what it would, what their rent would be to move to a comparable place. So if the difference for that was $125 a month over 42 months, it comes out to that 5250 figure. And that's what that city arrived at. Another city had $7,200. The city of LA actually has $5,000 max. So there's nothing magic about it. We're just trying to come up with something that's reasonable. The one thing, what this does is it does provide the different parties with a known expectation up front, which is, you know, I would consider that to be an advantage of having something like that. But the disadvantage might be that the cost may be more than $5,000 or $5,250 or whatever the dollar amount set is. So it does put that cap on there. That's something to consider. The second alternative would be essentially the city just says, look, to a developer that's ready to, or providing, proposing to do a TIF project, look, we won't accept your application right now. We want you to deal with the relocation issue. You work with this seller of property. You guys negotiate the terms of your sale and any relocation related to that between the two parties, and we'll accept your application once you've dealt with it. Obviously, the advantage to that is, you know, essentially the city is not involved with the relocation issue. It's the two parties that are involved in the real estate transaction. And then the last alternative that we were suggesting is one that council member Campion mentioned the other day, was why not look at doing a minimum amount rather than a maximum cap? You know, certainly could do that. The advantage to that is it's going to ensure that there's funding that you cover the cost for the displaced tenants. Disadvantages to that, though, is that it's a pretty big unknown for a developer on the front end of a project. It has the potential to, you know, jeopardize their project financing, that unknown. And then the other aspect of that is it could lead to a fairly significant increase in the amount of TIF assistance requested for the project, because that would be included as probably part of their land acquisition related costs. So that's kind of what we're struggling with here. As I said, there's no right or wrong way about this. Cities do it in each of these manners. So we just wanted to get some feedback from the council. I felt that doing the max cap was sort of that reasonable compromise, and something that a developer should be able to live with. And at least provide some relocation assistance to a displaced tenant.
Okay, that's for Vicki.
Yeah, I would definitely support number two. I'm not sure why we would take on the obligation of the developer. I'm not sure, maybe provide, what's the definition of a displaced tenant? So we're talking about they've broken the lease agreement that they have with the tenant, so it's a private contract. I think, you know, I would see it as their obligation. If they've got a contract with an individual, it's their obligation to clean that up.
And that's what, you know, I found, and that's what essentially was the case with all of those tenants except for the one here in that last project that we did here. You know, they had worked out those terms of agreements, and that's pretty typical practice. And I can't say that I disagree. I mean, obviously, from the standpoint of the staff, it's something we don't have to be involved in, and the city's sort of out of the fray there. But I guess, you know, obviously, if you start looking at it from other perspectives, such as, you know, the city trying to provide a benefit to those citizens and ensure that, you know, displaced tenants are taken care of properly.
Obligation.
Right.
So if they've got a private contract and they breach this contract, it's up to them to remedy it. I don't see it as a city obligation to follow up behind the developer and clean up, you know, something else they're doing. So again, the individual could certainly receive the benefit.
It's, in my mind, it's the developer's obligation.
As you know, and it was mentioned in the memo, you know, our only, when I say our, the city's only obligation to do the relocation is if it's a city project, or, you know, we're involved in the real estate transaction. Just providing the financial assistance doesn't require it. So.
So I tend to follow a line of thinking not dissimilar from that about wanting the city to step out. But my fear is like the vulnerability of the people that are being approached. So there's a breach of contract between some apartment complex owner and some vulnerable Section 8 eligible tenants. Can you tell me what type of grounds they have to stand on? Is that just dependent on the contract that they signed into?
Yeah, I think it's just dependent on whatever agreements that are in place between those particular parties.
While I want to stay out of it, I also feel an obligation to protect the really vulnerable people that could be down 10% of AMI, unable to relocate essentially without some sort of financial assistance. The second part of that is, it's a TIF-eligible expense. Anything they spend this way is TIF-eligible?
Relocation is treated as an acquisition expense, and acquisition is a TIF-eligible expenditure.
So I have a separate formula. Okay, you're on a roll. I have a separate formula that I wanted consideration for. I don't know if I included that in my note.
I think there was one that I saw, Nick, the other day. It was a minimum, and then it had... I forgot exactly how you had it.
But it was a maximum that's dependent on the AMI of the individual that is being relocated. So it essentially ramps up. The lower that the AMI is, the more relocation resources we bring.
No, I remember seeing it on Nick. Yeah.
And in particular, I think what we see is, as in this particular instance, the most vulnerable people have needs beyond simply a moving van, beyond simply addressing the disparity between the rents. They also have construction needs, you know, or they need to have habitable expenses that need to happen prior to them taking residence in a new location. So I actually, you know, I would prefer the city stays out of it. What I can't figure out is how we stay out of it and still protect the most vulnerable people that are really concerning to me.
I see your point, and maybe the way we deal with it is to essentially indicate that we won't provide or deal with it except in instances where individuals are at whatever you determine to be a reasonable income level or AMI. You know, I think that my recollection, Nick, but from your example, was a 50% was sort of that top threshold, and then it went down from there. I mean, that's...
And what if we just, to take staff time away, what if we just printed out what we expect the agreements to be? Here's the dollar amount. Here's what the agreement is. Tell us what their AMI is. Here's what it's going to be. You go get these signed. Don't come back to us until you have these signed.
Conceivably, that would be something we could put something like that, using that formula that you mentioned, together in a form. And then as part of their TIF application, we would just need to see evidence that, at the time their submittal of the application, that they've dealt with that relocation.
I'm not hearing outright rejection, so I'm going to take it as one that's...
I mean, that is something that I think isn't unreasonable.
Thank you. Councilman Bilbeck?
Thank you. I do like alternative two, and I do like the little add-in that Mr. Campion put in there, because I think the fact is these groups will work harder to get it done so they can get to us. They want to work on timetables. It's something they can add their TIF request, that's fine. I think that makes sense. I do have a concern. I think Mr. Campion voiced very well about those that may be at a disadvantage because of where they may already fall in the AMIs. I'm willing to work with that, but I really like alternative two for the most part. I think we just have to make sure we set our specifications up and let the developer know what our expectations are as they go forward.
I think that's something that could be doable. I think the other thing to keep in mind is, Gary, you've been doing TIF projects here for 35 years. I've been around in city admin for 20 years. we've only run across this scenario once in 20 years. It's not
run into it again.
Well, I know. So it's not a common situation. I think it's something we can address. If the council would be so inclined, I mean, I'd be happy to take a crack at putting together something based on what Councilmember Campion had suggested. You know, and I could bring that back, and then if that was reasonable to the council, we could incorporate that into the TIF policy document, and then I would just at that point bring the TIF policy document back for formal approval at a council meeting at some point, if that makes sense.
Can I just assage Councilman Hickey's? I think the idea is generally we pull ourselves out of relocation of market even relocation, because in theory, as we develop more, there should be more spots. That's how it's going to work. We can set some sort of minimum threshold. If the AMI, the average rental price, is falling below a certain spot, or the average immediate income of the tenants is falling below a certain, then you go into system two, which would be a more structured relocation program that you're going to operate based on our formulas. You come in, don't even come talk to us until you have everything signed. We're out of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
If that makes sense, I'll try and pull something like that together.
Sounds like
that's the details.
Yeah, obviously. What would be the next step on this? Would it be to bring back to the council for formal approval then?
I'd like to bring it back for further discussion to make sure the council is okay with it before it comes for any type of formal action.
Okay.
If that works, I'm happy to.
And thanks for answering all my questions.
It's a difficult issue to deal with. I can tell you, I've tried to do as much research as I can, and like I said, I don't think anybody has it right. It's all over the board. Thank you for all your consideration.
All right, we have our meeting schedule attached. You can take a look at that for the future. Is there any other business? Mr. Rimer.
I think I just bring some, kind of summarize what happened, what things that we heard and maybe didn't hear. One thing I'd like to touch on is the point that Councilmember Campion made. He talked about building up units versus getting the cash, and that's a policy level discussion that would be good for the council to have in light of the different programs. It may help provide some guidance to which of those options to pick. It's a common discussion going on around the country. Do you want the money? Do you want the units? Do you want the units integrated in different projects? So it's something that, as we continue down this path and work with the HRA, we appreciate being here. Those type of conversations we should continue to have.
Thank you. One question I would have with that is if I'd like to see the whole process, and if we were going to go that direction, where would the funds be collected? Who would administer them, and how they'd be managed?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So kind of a more detail, if we're going to look at that too, would be how it would work. So.
Yeah, and we're thinking right now that obviously the large policy questions and then flexibility is a piece of that. That's typically you want flexibility within a program.
Good. Okay. Any other comments?
Yeah, on that particular note, I would say I'm pretty iffy on supporting a policy that does not obligate some amount of units to be provided in the development. I would like to see flexibility generally given on what the number is, what the AMI is. If we're going to go the route of a fund, which I guess I'm not by any means saying I'm dead set against that, and I think that can play an important role, I think before I can go that route, we have to answer some of the questions that Councilmember Ruska just brought up, which is just having the money does not actually do anything for the community. We're basically putting it into a purse, and how we are going to be able to distribute that and what we're going to be able to do with it is actually what we're trying to achieve. So if it comes back and we have a big purse of money we can only use in very specific circumstances, we haven't really accomplished our goal here. And so then I'm going to lean much more heavily toward we obligate the units. So I would like to see, and I don't know if that was already kind of understood, I would like to see a description of what can that money be used for, what are the circumstances under which it can be leveraged, and what gaps will it leave is probably a really important one, because I imagine, given the strings attached to some of that money, we will continue to see gaps in what we can accomplish if we rely on it. So that would be my hope.
It would seem it would run fairly parallel to the programs such as the park dedication that we have that we've been doing for years. I don't know if it's perfect and it pleases everybody, but it's been a pretty effective program, and I think we've got some history with that we could look at comparables there. So, okay. Yeah, Mr. Newman.
I would say, too, that more than likely you're going to end up using it in combination or partnerships with some of the other groups involved, such as the HRA or the RAF group, you know, because a lot of times to do a significant project or to, you know, really have some impact, probably you may have to bundle different funding sources, so it's quite possible that it'll be through one of those partnerships that you're doing.
Very good. Okay. If there's no other business, then we'll call it a day. Thank you.
I was trying to find a good old scramble looking at these. I don't think you can talk to them with the TIF to use it for rehab.
So
the TIF, you know, use it for rehab? I may be able to use the full length of it.
I know what you're talking about is I'm not as comfortable with that.
Other than on that
project,
the one we did for the
Zurich,
there we have
cash.
For some of these other
reasons. That's my son.
Wow.
I know, I would like to find a...
also, it's hardly on my phone. I guess find a statute here that allows you to use it for affordable housing,
because I think it just says for affordable housing. I don't think it specifies like construction or different issues.
Or you could probably... I can see why you said it was more
yeah, I bought this at homecoming.